Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Americans tend to have a fire and brimstone relationship with food. Every generation divides different groups, grains, delicacies into good and bad, healthy and heart-stopping. It's a feast or fast approach that lurks behind American obesity, dieting, and faddish food cures. My guest today, Frederick Kaufman, says you can trace it all the way back to the Puritans and the notion that what's in our stomachs reflects what's in our souls. This hour, On Point, a short history of the American stomach and our extremes of consumption and digestion. Joining me now from New York is Frederick Kaufman. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, professor of journalism at the Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York. He's just out with his new book, A Short History of the American Stomach. Frederick Kaufman, thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Tom. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing okay, though I'm a little apprehensive here. Something about you're following American history through along the winding road of the American intestine. What?
Well, we haven't come to the cloaca yet, so we should be fine.
Well, where are you diving in here? What are you trying to teach us, Frederick?
Well, you know, the American stomach has always been unfairly ghettoized and set aside, and it really belongs in the middle of American history.
So you say, right here, the American stomach lies at the center of this of the American idea. Okay,
well,
make your case in a hurry.
Yeah. The center of the body should be center of the history, of course.
All right, I guess. So we're down at your something chakra there and looking for history in it. I don't know, anchor us somewhere. Make your case that the stomach's at the center of American history.
Well, you know, I think that we can go back to the very beginnings. We go back to the Dutch. We can go back to the Puritans. The Puritans, for example, believed that the stomach was the center of their psychology, the center of good and evil, and they could understand one's relationship to God through their relationship with the stomach. They felt that if you wanted to get Satan out of your body, the best way was through the stomach. This is an unknown and unfairly neglected part of American history. The Dutch, too, in New York were, as Washington Irving called them, a colony of great eaters, and he insisted that the fattest of them were the ones who would be the rulers. From the beginning, eating too much and eating too little have been with us, and the manias and the fears of eating have been with us from the start.
We're going to look at those manias right back to the Puritans and the Dutch and all the rest up through, you name it, the spawn of Daniel Boone and the fables of Paul Bunyan and all the rest.
How about Benjamin Franklin? I mean, here's a guy who
our
also
first foodie,
was obsessed
you call him.
With his stomach, a Cotton Mather, exactly.
Speaking of obsessed with the stomach, you're no small player yourself on that score. You've got an article in Harper's this week about the sort of tail end of the digestive path. Here you are.
Well, Tom, we don't have to go there. We don't have to go there, Tom.
Well, but it's all part of the circle of life. Is there something about you personally that takes you to the guts as the font of insight about the human soul, the American way?
Well, I always was interested in body science and American bodies and thinking about the body and trying to also understand the American Revolution and how that happened. It came to me that I thought maybe people back then were thinking about their bodies somewhat differently than we were thinking about our bodies today. So I started looking at the medicine of the Federalist period, and guess what I discovered? It was always the same kinds of manias and food fetishes were there. In fact, at the time of the American Revolution, the stomach and stomach science was at the center of medicine as opposed to today when, once again, it's been a bit off to the side. And it stayed in the center of American medicine for quite some time. In fact, the American Encyclopedia of 1811 remarked that the most grave disease threatening American at the time was dyspepsia, the horrors of dyspepsia, and the endless essays on indigestion that appeared throughout the 1820s and 1830s in the Jacksonian period really paved the way for the great flowering of American gastrosophy. These are the ancestors of people like Suzanne Somers today and even somebody like Michael Pollan, the great diet gurus of today, really can trace their ancestry back to the haute bourgeois food culture of the early 19th century.
Well, here we are. It's late January. I'm sure lots of Americans are in some kind of bipolar relationship right now with food.
Everybody's made their New Year's resolutions, and now are in the process of struggling to hang on to them. So it's this sort of black and white, I will do it, I won't do it, hopes and fears about food. So I'm sure people can relate to what you're saying and probably don't doubt that it's got exactly those roots. You write, Frederick, the United States was and remains one of the most gut-centric and gut-phobic societies in the history of human civilization. Take us further into the early demonstrations of that.
Well, Cotton Mather was an early Puritan and one of the great divines of New England, and he felt that he called the stomach the main digester, and he felt that what you would put into the stomach and what came out of the stomach was a direct indicator of your spiritual health and well-being. Therefore, if you were somehow had a bad relationship, and if you were had a satanic relationship, clearly this could be removed by the suspected means, by the usual means. And he was a great theorist of emesis of all kinds, and he could get stuff out of your stomach by any and all means.
It sounds like Roman priests reading oracle bones or something. I mean, were they really that? Did he spend much time with this? This wasn't just something he, you know, scribbled in it on the margins of a diary one day?
No, he wrote an entire book called The Angel of Bethesda. And I happen to actually read this thing. It's about 700 pages long. And I would say a good two-thirds of it is stomach. And in this, he outlines the most fashionable pukes of his time. That's a quote from him. And like I say, the problem with early American eating, a lot of the problem with early American eating was too much of reliance, as today, on meat. There happened to be plenty of meat on the American continent. There happened to be plenty of food. And, of course, there were intestinal parasites that came from the meat. And a lot of people, of course, suffered from worms. There is a great incidence in pre-colonial times of men and women suffering from intestinal worms. And, of course, Cotton Mather was witness at many times when these worms would be removed through the mouth from the stomach, and he recounts one worm that was brought out inch by inch until it measured over 100 feet long, black, thin worms emerging from the stomach. And to him, this was a clear indicator of satanic possession, and another, an even clearer indicator that this was being cured by the physical removal of the worm from the stomach.
I thought handling snakes was the holy roller way. I never thought of tapeworms on that front. Did his congregations buy this? I mean, were Americans going around imagining their dyspepsia, their stomach ache, was really an indicator of their spiritual unease? Was that widely, understood, followed, believed?
Absolutely. In fact, the greatest follower, a century later, the greatest follower of Cotton Mather was the greatest physician of the Federalist period, the signer of the Declaration of Independence, Benjamin Rush, the great doctor from Philadelphia. And he was the great believer in the puke. He was the great believer in the stomach as the way to health.
What do you mean when you say believer in the puke? Like, do it and see what's there and know thyself?
This was the cure for almost all diseases was, as in Cotton Mather's time, getting things out of the body. And so there were endless lists of the ways in which you could make people get rid of whatever was ailing them. And the,
out you
the
demon
vomit.
Sort of a thing.
Yeah, precisely. Well, with Benjamin Rush, of course, we're dealing with a different point in the history of science. Mm-hmm. And so he is no longer very focused on demonology. I have to go back to Cotton Mather for a time. You have to realize that Cotton Mather, when he's talking about demons, he is not talking about superstition. To Cotton Mather, Satan was science. He was a scientist, Cotton Mather, and he was talking about the most scientific way to get rid of Satan. Well, Benjamin Rush doesn't really mention Satan, but he inherits this great theory of bulimorexia, which comes forth fully formed from the Puritans. And so Benjamin Rush is the most influential doctor of the Revolutionary period. Benjamin Franklin, of course, is a great follower of Rush, Benjamin Rush's, and he also is a great one of our first diet gurus. He is absolutely obsessed with what to eat and what not to eat and the relationship between oatmeal and liberty and this sort of thing.
Please elaborate on that relationship between oatmeal and liberty. I was thinking of lower LDL or something, cholesterol issues. I guess not then.
No. You see, what we've inherited today is really this much more direct relationship, first of all, spiritual, but second of all, political, that our American ancestors really understood in terms of their own stomach. So Benjamin Franklin, for instance, his great diet guru was a guy named Thomas Trine, who was one of the great vegetarians of the 18th century. And Thomas Trine wrote a book called The Way to Health, which, of course, Franklin eventually imitated in his great book, The Way to Wealth. and, of course, in The Way to Wealth, the very first metaphor of the book is money is solid pudding. And Franklin, as I say before, outlined the 13 virtues in his autobiography that would lead any American the way to a perfect life. This, of course, deals with our American insistence on perfection, our American belief that we can be perfect, and perfect eaters, of course, is the way to begin this. And, of course, Franklin's first commandment to this nascent nation was don't eat too much. Temperance. Do not eat to excess. That's the first commandment to Americans from Benjamin Franklin.
Now, in the paintings I've seen, I'm not sure that Bonnie Benn followed that admonition himself. But we'll come back and talk about that. Jim's calling from Rockport, Massachusetts. Hi, Jim. You're on the air with Frederick Kaufman.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm somebody who had part of my stomach removed August 30th of this year.
Why?
Well, it was, it's a long story. I'll try to make short here. I had problems 4 years ago when I lived in Florida. They couldn't diagnose it. I was passing what I would describe as flesh. I know it's not something great to talk about.
Oh, geez, I'm fainting.
I was in increasing pain. Bottom line is they had to do an endoscopy to go in and see. Finally, I was told after they took it out, took part of my stomach, there was a tumor inside. When I was in the embryo stage, I'm told, part of my pancreas, when it was developing, threw off a couple cells, stuck to the stomach wall, and tried to actually make a new pancreas.
Holy moly. We're in high science and high medicine. Did you feel like it was some kind of, I don't know, were you expelling evil spirits when they got rid of that, or just having an operation, Jim?
Well, both. It made, of course, I felt a whole lot better, but I was in a lot of pain before that, and it took a long time. And I had insurance all the way through down south in Florida and up here. I thought the healthcare system up here they really got to the problem, whereas in Florida the healthcare system was terrible. But
the thing is expelled and out of there. And maybe you're one for the history, medical history books. Jim, thanks very much for that. Let's get another from Rutland, Vermont, and Robert. Frederick, please.
I just want to comment about what Jim was saying about stomach science, which I think is really, really interesting in some ways, because a lot of people don't realize that Americans have led the way in stomach science ever since 1822. And what Jim was telling us reminded me of what happened to a French-Canadian Mountie named Alexis St. Martin, who was shot in the stomach. And what happened to this poor young Mountie is he had a permanent hole from outside his body to inside his stomach.
Okay.
Well, an American doctor named William Beaumont saw his opportunity and he took it, and using St. Martin's gastric fistula, discovered the secrets of digestion.
Peering in through the buckshot hole or whatever.
You got it. Peering in through what he would do is suspend meat through the buckshot hole, suspend our friend oatmeal through the buckshot hole, and he discovered the stomach secretions of enzymes and completely blew away all the European scientists. And from that point on, America has led the way in stomach science.
Was it just a lucky break that the Canadian Mountie with the hole in his gut was on the North American continent, or were Americans particularly obsessed with stomach science? Why?
Well, they had long been obsessed with stomach science. As I say before, the stomach was the center. And I think part of this is coincidence. The stomach happened to be the center not only of American science but European science in the decades that happened to be just previous to the American Revolution. And so the country's political fate and political writings are put together right around the time when the stomach and digestion is the center of world science.
And so it's kind of born and flourished, blossoming right along with the American Republic. Let's get a call.
The independent Constitution.
There you go. We're looking at our Constitution, and we mean
you got it.
Our guts. Rutland, Vermont. Robert, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I was going to say, maybe your guest has already talked about Henry Adams, who recounted, as he called it, the nausea of a visioning French gourmet, Constantin Francois, I believe it's pronounced Chassé-Bouf, who said, "I will venture to say that if a prize were proposed for the scheme of a regimen most calculated to injure the stomach, the teeth, and the health in general, no better could be invented than that of the Americans." As he finally said, "The whole day passes in heaping indigestions." Again, going back a long time ago.
But this visiting French gourmand was dissing American cuisine on his...
Certainly was on his visit like that.
Robert, this is also a classic thing that you brought up, and I'm glad you have, because the French have long come to this country and visited America and had the precise same reaction. St. John de Crèvecoeur, with his Letters from an American Farmer, noted the American diet. He noted the American propensity to eat too much meat, and he said it tended to alter their temperament.
Do you believe it, Robert? Do you still see it today?
Yeah, I was going to say myself, again, you asked what would be for me. It would be my doctor who had to finally come to my rescue, if that's the word,
yes.
Between myself, and then I rescued myself, too. And just finally, I'll say before I go off that as far as cloned meat goes, I think we're going backwards instead of forward. So I'll leave you with that comment. Thank you.
Great, Robert.
Do you want me to discuss cloned meat here, Tom?
Well, I'm sure we're going to get to cloned meat, but I'm still thinking about that Frenchman's observation. Now, just because there's a lot of meat in a diet, we know there's health problems with that, but it wouldn't necessarily make for terrible cuisine. Was it bad? Was it crude? Was it rough and ready? It was a frontier country, after all, compared to Europe's.
This is a very interesting question. Ever since Henry Hudson sat down to a meal of fatted dog with some of the native Indians of New York State, Americans have been ready, willing, and able to eat almost everything. And, of course, when they were here, all of a sudden the world of eating opened up. They saw the Indians, the natives eating skunk and eating the bark of trees and horse hoof. And they realized all the old boundaries had been shattered. Everything, it was a new game here in America.
But we didn't end up eating skunk and horse hoof for Christmas.
Absolutely we did. Absolutely we did. And in fact, another little known fact is that the American markets in the 18th and 19th centuries completely blew away the European markets in terms of selection, in terms of the fish on sale, in terms of the birds on sale. I mean, there in New York markets in 1840, there were more than 30 kinds of duck you could purchase.
It sounds like a gourmet's delight, all that abundance. Why the down-the-nose criticism from the French visitor then?
There's always been the downside. There's always been the two sides. There's a sense of the Americans have this land of plenty. They have this unbelievable selection. All the boundaries are broken. They can eat anything they like. And then you have the food Protestants, and almost kind of a dialectical kind of arrangement. They hop up and then start saying it is evil to have more than two ingredients per dish. You know, nothing should ever be mashed. It's kind of a reaction formation, in a sense, to this incredible, ungodly plenty.
Did people buy that? They wanted a simple, wholesome, basic American cuisine. The less touch, the better. Was that the idea? The less touch.
Do
the
people
better?
Buy it? Do people buy it? Oh my Lord! Look at the marketplace today. Look at Michael Pollan's dicta: eat simple food. This has been the dicta in for the American stomach since the very beginnings. Of course, they buy it.
So when you see, whether it's Michael Pollan or so many others who have their kind of dicta that get handed down, do you see health talking, or do you see old-fashioned moralism, or is it always both in this country?
You can't separate one from the other. This is the great American gospel of health, which has been around since the very beginning. It was Marx Edgeworth Lazarus in his book Passional Hygiene in the 1850s who discussed the outcropping of a whole generation of American gastrosophers. Gastrosophers are going to lead the way to the future harmony. And gastrosophers are Michael Pollan and Suzanne Somers.
That is philosophers of food.
Gastrosophers, precisely. Absolutely. These are the ones, and they were going to lead the way to the future harmony. And of course they have.
If we would only eat right, buy the books and read and eat exactly what they say. Douglas is calling from Mansfield, Massachusetts. Douglas, you're on the air.
Tom, welcome back. First
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Kaufman, I'd like to know, talking about the gastrostophers, my father passed away at age 72 while the doctors looked on and didn't say to him things like, you know, your father's committing slow suicide with his food issues. I'm in the 12-step programs. I wonder if you could address two points. One is addiction to food, and the second is, in general, the FDA's role in our diet.
Addiction to food? Do you fear that your father had some kind of addiction to food, Douglas?
Absolutely, Tom.
Can you tell us a little
bit? Just the sugar and fat and the regular stuff, or what?
Yeah, he was born into Frankfurt, Germany in the mid-20s, and I think that in our family of origin, food was the drug of choice, with alcohol being a close second. And I just like to bring to the conversation the whole piece about addiction and the spiritual quality that food represents to people who eat unhealthily in their diets.
There's a big vein in the FDA, too. What about it, Frederick? Addiction, self-medication through food. And I mean, here we are an immigrant nation, so it's not as though all this, here's a Frankfurter, his dad, born anyway. It's not as though all this happened in a vacuum.
Well, of course, you know, food has long been a drug, and this is not just even an American phenomenon, but food, you know, drugs come from food, and the Americans did most of their medicine through food from the very beginning. And Americans were also very fearful of the drugs and the propensities of food, of too much meat, of too much sugar, all the way from the very beginning. And they are particularly concerned, as they are today, about children, you know, and how children ought to be fed. So William Alcott, who was the most famous graduate of Yale Medical School of 1827, he was a fabulous and incredible advocate of simple diet as a basis for economic justice, because he felt that people were eating food that was causing them injury, that was causing them addiction, and therefore then they had children, and the children were inheriting this, and therefore he advised the American housewives to give their children only the simplest kinds of foods.
But he's the one who said nothing ought to be mashed before it's
eaten. Absolutely.
What's simple about that? I mean, some of this stuff gets lost on me through the mists of time. I don't understand the connection.
Well, of course, you know, we're looking at a time. It's a very good point. If you mash something, you're spending time mashing it as opposed to eating it raw. And of course, the American housewife was spending too much time obsessing over her food. Sound familiar? So instead, Alcott said, okay, we should have a raw diet. Again, sounds a little familiar. Mm. And we should not spend so much time mashing our food and preparing our food and using all these different ingredients. In fact, he was a great advocate of single substance eating, which in fact became quite a phenomena in America. There are people who spent, you know, would brag, I spent an entire year only eating apples, or I spent an entire year only eating crackers. And then, of course,
if they were still alive at the end of that year.
And these were people who then went to perfectionist communities like Fruitlands to have perfectionist eating experiences and to form utopias. And of course, this then dovetailed with a lot of the more normative concerns about addiction of the time. So, for instance, Mary Mann wrote a book in the 1850s called Christianity in the Kitchen, which dealt with these precise concerns that we're looking at today of, for instance, Victoria Moran and her diet book, Love Yourself Thin. In other words, it's a Christian loving approach to your foodstuffs, and this is going to be the cure to addiction.
But was it that, let's say, her book, 19th Century Christianity in the Kitchen, was it opposed to the kind of joy of life style of eating? Was that also a call for simplicity, or what was she suggesting?
It certainly was a rival cookbook to Miss Eliza Leslie, who was the great cookbook author of the time, whose cookbooks sold hundreds of thousands of copies. And in fact, Miss Eliza Leslie, by the time she was in her dotage, was so capacious she couldn't walk anymore. She had to be wheeled around. But she was a great Boston wit, and she would have – her cookbooks included the most amazing recipes for gooseberry fool and raspberry charlotte and these unbelievable fat and sugar concoctions. You have to remember the very first American cookbook by Amelia Simmons in 1796 has has a recipe for federal pancake, which includes 20 quarts of sugar.
Hello. Now we're eating something. That brings us to the dieters. Already in the 19th century, you remind us, there were diet gurus. What were they advising?
Well, you know, what are they advising today? That's what they were advising then. They were the exact same kinds of controversies. Meat good, meat bad. Sugar good, sugar bad. Oil good, oil bad. It was straight down the line. Eat complicated things and be a foodie. Eat simple things and be a chowhound.
Sort of pick your poison, pick your way, pick your salvation.
The exact same phenomena. That's what really blew me away. When I started looking back at this history and I saw the exact same things as Atkins versus Pritikin writ large in the 1820s, I was blown away.
Let's get a call from Burlington, Vermont. And Sylvie. Hi, Sylvie. You're on the air.
Hi there. How you doing?
Pretty good. What do you know?
I've actually spent a lot about food and politics. I lived in Philadelphia for a while, and the thing to be in Philadelphia among the certain leftist circles was a vegan. And those who were most virtuous and most leftist, the ones who were most least respectful of the police and the, you know, their, it was around the time of the convention when they were having all the protests.
So vegan anarchists, those are people, almost. There.
Those are the people who are also vegans, you know. And, yeah, it just struck me that there was this confluence of, you know, virtue politically as well as virtue dietetically. And it stands in contrast to where I live now in Burlington, Vermont, where, you know, there are still those same people with the same political views, but for some reason veganism is not the thing here. It's
maybe not veganism, but then I think of Vermont as a state quite political around issues of food and organic and all the rest. Frederick, you've mentioned religion and food, but here Sylvie brings in politics and food ways.
Absolutely. When I made my way into a raw milk coven in New York City, a secret conventicle of people who were only going to drink unhomogenized milk straight from the cow. Right, I was in a secret meeting of these people where they were selling raw milk and raw yogurt. The great fear among the raw milk crowd were the vegans. They thought that perhaps one of these soy milk drinking, almond chomping, tattooed vegans would infiltrate their ranks
and rat them out or carrot them out or whatever. Exactly,
with New York State Milk Authority. And I thought that was very interesting to see, you know, the two sides of food extremism all of a sudden butting heads. I think it's also instructive to note a new coinage, a new word I just noticed last week in my trolling of foodie sites and foodie language, which is, of course, I guess the word is vegan. But this word, I guess, would be pronounced vegansexual. The vegansexual, who is a vegan who chooses only to have sex with other vegans.
Amy is calling from Harvard, Massachusetts. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi. I actually live not 2 miles from Fruitlands, where the experiment with the Alcotts and apples and crackers happened.
Right.
But I'm calling about the Little House on the Prairie books by Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Mm-hmm.
I have an 8-year-old daughter, and so we read the whole series just a year ago. And I'm a vegetarian, and I just found myself thinking about food the entire time reading those books. They were on the frontier. And, you know, whether it was the first book where they did everything themselves in Wisconsin or in the long winter where they nearly starved to death and spend 2 months, I think, feeding a family of five on 125 pounds of wheat. It just was an amazing story of the American frontier and food.
Frederick Kaufman, there's a big edge of American life and culture and history. Take us to the frontier and what flows back into our food culture today from that whole time and experience.
Well, frontier eating was, of course, incredibly formative in terms of our whole notion of manifest destiny and our whole notion of consuming the entire continent. And in fact, there is the great metaphors of the frontiersmen were eating metaphors and how much they would consume. And of course, there was a dark side to this. Clearly, there is a dark side of this. The Mississippi backwoodsmen shouting that, you know, that blood was their natural drink. Davy Crockett said he would eat any man opposed to Jackson. So remember, cannibalism clearly plays a role in our frontier experiences. There's a great history of extraordinarily violent eating.
You quote Washington Irving before we got too far on that frontier, declaring that the barbarous nations of antiquity immolated human victims to the memory of their lamented dead, but the enlightened Americans offer up whole hecatombs of geese and calves and oceans of wine in honor of the illustrious living. We know how to do it.
Yeah, we certainly do know how to feast. I think what's also interesting about the prairie is that our notion of it today is also transformed from the notion it was back then to the sense that when the prairie closed in 1790, you know, and the famous Frederick Jackson Turner's notion that there is no more frontier left in 1890, no more frontier left. Around that time, all of a sudden Americans experienced this great nostalgia for frontier eating, and you would see these extraordinarily expensive meals put together by Buffalo Bill and his ilk, in which they would set up these black tie dinners in the middle of the prairie, and they would eat like salmi of prairie dog and all these bizarre
venison.
Yeah, precisely, because people wanted to get back to that sense of frontier eating and consuming the continent that somehow had something to do with their sense of who they were as Americans.
Remind us of the Paul Bunyan lore, which comes into this great gustatory enthusiasm, at least for volume, and then the Boone family legacy.
Well, absolutely. Well, you know, Paul Bunyan was one of America's great legendary eaters. He would only eat raw moose meat. And, of course, you know, the legend surrounding
I'm with Paul on that.
The legend surrounding his axemen, he would have seven cement mixers set up just to make their pancake batter in the morning. Their griddle was so large that the cooks would wear ice skates and go around on the griddle, on the oil of the griddle, in order to prepare the food.
So there's the tall tale, but you've got the Boones who actually got into big eating. Dale Boone, what is that, the offspring of Daniel?
That's right. I happen to be honored to spend some time with Dale Boone, otherwise known as the Mouth from the South. And Dale Boone is a professional competitive eater, and he holds quite a number of records. He's a fabulous eater. He always wears a coonskin hat. And, you know, competitive eating is something we haven't discussed yet, but the International Federation of Competitive Eating it could only have happened in this country, and it's also come under incredible, opprobrium. They're wasting. But this is so American, this insistence on eating as much as we can, as quickly as we can. And the first competitive eating contest in this country did take place in the late 18th century, in the 1780s, and it was a gentleman who was down at the South Street Seaport in New York City, and he stood on a box and he ate in a matter of 15 minutes 50 hard-boiled eggs, shell and all.
Okay, and
that's a pretty good record.
That's too much. Well, it could have been hot dogs. I don't know what's worse. Let's take a call from Brooklyn, New York. Carrie, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is in regards to the school of thought about meat. I have some friends that think because we are hunter-gatherers and we were always eating meat, that's what our diet should be today. I am like what you mentioned earlier, Tom, when you said, are you eating poached salmon and broccoli and feel, you know, virtuous about it? That's
yes.
How I feel.
That's you, huh?
These friends are always trying to get me to eat red meat, and I was curious what your guests thought, because especially when your guests mentioned how the French were so surprised at how much meat we ate, and, you know, what do you think is about that school of thought that we should be eating meat because that's what we had been eating?
The Atkins diet. Put it in historical perspective for us, Frederick.
Well, not only the Atkins diet, but my favorite is the is the caveman diet, which had a little bit of a vogue a couple of years ago. We should eat what those cavemen were eating, and this has to do with, I think, the American sense of belatedness on this continent. We were late. We got here, and there are people here before us. That kind of irked us a little bit. We wanted to be first. Therefore, a lot of our diets are striving for this primal, eldest diet. And, you know, what would Jesus eat? This sort of thing. And in fact, only in this country do we have Christian diets, not only Merry Man, but more modern ones in which we're trying to eat hyssop and all sorts of strange, very early foods, because this is clearly the way to health. And of course, health, who knows what it means in this country? Is it spiritual health? Is it bodily health? It reminds me, however, the great meat-eating tradition in this country reminds me of one of the perhaps most amazing moments of meat-eating, which was right after the federal constitution was ratified. New York City decided they would celebrate the fact that the country had a new constitution.
Yeah, good.
So on July 23rd, 1788, the butchers of New York City organized a fat parade. And this was the original ticker tape parade. It went down Broadway. They carried about 10,000 pounds of fatted calves and butchered meat.
Fat City, as it were.
This is how they celebrated the Constitution.
Hey, I guess you celebrate with what you've got. Champagne maybe was in short supply. Let's get a call from Aiken, South Carolina, and Bernadette. Hello, Bernadette. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I'm just calling to, my questions and what I would like in a way to hear the reaction to is, first of all, the variety of vegetables that you have in Europe or in the Middle East, actually in Mediterranean countries, as opposed to, you know, the variety is far less in the U.S. when you go to the supermarket. This is my first thing. The second thing is I'm wondering also if this, you know, the relationship to diets in America is not linked to the American psyche of, you know, you have crusades, you know, where you all go to spread democracy, or you all go to spread, low carb, or you all go to spread, low sugar, low whatever, low fat, even on, packages or on food where obviously you have no carb in it, but it will still be.
So are we crusading on food? Bernadette, do I hear a French accent in?
Yes, you do, but I've been living, I've lived in 9 different countries and worked in 9 different countries, so it's not,
We do recall a few crusaders coming out of Europe once upon a time, but maybe that was a different time and a different way. What about the variety that Bernadette Frederick says, you know, there's a lot more in Europe. Pity you Americans on the veggie front.
I think it's a very interesting point. I think that traditionally the variety in American markets has been with fish and fowl and with game. I think increasingly with the retail success of Trader Joe's and Whole Foods, we're seeing the vegetables moving into to the American culture. I think it's also interesting that a lot of work being done by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, a lot of the secret work, stuff that we don't really hear a lot about, has to do with transformation of fruit shape. You know, we hear a lot about cloned animals these days. But I was just talking to a researcher out in the Midwest a couple of weeks ago who's isolating fruit shape genes so that they can custom shape fruit.
Now, this is new to me. Do you mean to have the perfectly shaped apple or to have an apple shaped like, I don't know, birthday cake?
Well, I think there are many parts of this. One would be, what is the perfect tomato? And maybe to you, Tom, your perfect tomato is not my perfect tomato. So there's a whole issue there, an aesthetic issue. The other issue is the industrial issue. I think that there are people who work for Heinz and Del Monte who would just love to see a square tomato because they can pack more in a box. You know, with a round tomato, you're losing some space. But if you're going to make tomato paste out of the stuff, why not get a square tomato? I know that McDonald's, I'm sure, would be quite interested in an extraordinarily elongated salami-like tomato because they're going to have less waste when they start chopping for the burgers.
Right. So if we can have cloned meat on the shelves, why not genetically engineered and shaped fruits and vegetables? Where do you think the cloned meat and milk from cloned cows business is going to go? The FDA says okay. The Agriculture Department not quite ready to completely green light it yet, and lots of consumers expressing hesitation at the least about it, given the history of this country. Do you think cloned meat will take, or is that going to be put in the, you know, the devil's closet?
Well, I think the uproar and the hysteria about cloned meat, I think this is all typical of American food mania. I think, however, if we really take a long, hard look at this, so we think about genetically modified not only meat but fruit and vegetables, guess what? We lost the battle a long, long time ago. People don't realize this. The fact of the matter is that almost every fruit and vegetable that you're eating has been patented and is somebody else's intellectual property. We are constantly eating modified foods. I want to make another point, which is that Americans have this great fantasy that they can eat primal foods, that they can eat pure foods, and by eating pure foods, they can be pure.
As pure and fresh as the continent that they first set foot on and all that.
That's beautiful. That's poetry. That's poetry to the American. Absolutely. And so the retailers, of course, are no dummies, and they figure out what do Americans want on their loaf of bread. They want an ingredient label that says flour, water, salt, nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how is that possible to get a retail loaf of bread that only has three ingredients? I'll tell you how it's possible. No artificial ingredients? Fine. The only way to do it is by using genetically modified enzymes. Almost every foodstuff that you're seeing from breads to beer on American supermarket shelves has been made possible through the miracle of genetically modified enzymes. And you know, the great thing about the enzyme is that it does not have to be reported on the ingredient label.
And so
because it's not there, because it's used in the processing of the food, but then it's extracted before it can finally hit the shelves. So this whole thing is a ruse. This has been going on forever, and we cannot get away from genetic modification of our food. We can't, not in Europe, not here. What does organic mean anymore? The restrictions and regulations for organic make all this possible anyway.
We've got so many callers who want in. Let me try and get another one or two. Semele from Boston, you're on the air with Frederick Kaufman.
I too have made a resolution this year to become a vegetarian. And I did it for two reasons. You bring up this genetically modified food issue. And also, you know, I discovered that more land is being used for, you know, cattle, you know, to support the cattle industry.
Our time is short. Take us to your question, Semele, please.
Sure. I wondered what you thought about Michael Pollan's research in the supposed organic produce that's being exported out of China and how the lack of equivalent FDA standards as they stand today deceive American consumers into thinking that we're actually buying organic food. I mean, what exactly are we putting into our mouths?
Frederick Kaufman, Michael Pollan, The Omnivore's Dilemma, then there's China and, foreign food. What is that? Yellow peril? We've got all kinds of history here, too.
Let me tell you, I was just talking to some scientists last week up in Oregon. We were talking about the threat that, for instance, Chinese apples might pose to American markets. And you know, it's true that the Chinese are planting apple orchards and harvesting apples and certainly gaining market share of apples. And you know what? The only way we're going to be able to compete with the Chinese is through technology. We can't compete with them with labor cost. In China, you're getting apple pickers working for a dollar a day. Can't have that in this country, and rightfully so.
Mm-hmm.
However, at the same, you can't have everything. What you're going to have to use is an apple which perhaps has some DNA in it, which is going to make it resistant to a pesticide. Now, imagine that. Why? I do not understand why people who are so against global warming and they say, look at the science. Well, when it comes to food, they refuse to look at the science. We are all made of DNA. We have fish DNA in us. Vegetables have animal DNA in them. That's just the way we are.
So it's not going to bother you. I've got one more question for you.
Absolutely.
After all this look at history, you say this country, the USA, will persist in its obsessions, its food obsessions, until it digests the world. What do you mean?
What I mean is that the American, as they say in academia, the American food ways have increasingly become globalized food ways. And on a certain level, we can see that, you know, with the retailers of McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken going global. But I think actually we can see it as just the general imperialist mode of eating, which was born in this country, which is being exported. And eventually we're going to see its second and third stages in which the virtues and vices of eating will also be exported globally.
Well, Paul Bunyan strides the whole planet now, and it's more than moose on his plate and a lot of great history to look back on. Frederick Kaufman's new book is A Short History of the American Stomach. Frederick, thanks so much for your work on it and for sharing with us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much.
Great to have you. Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Download the On Point podcast. No food menu, but the podcast is all there at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.